Hey everyone, it's Chris. I hope we are doing okay today. You're probably wondering, if you're a regular listener, where you've been for the last few months. Well, we decided to take a bit of a break for, basically we've been going for 10 years, it's our 10 year anniversary, from just doing the regular episodes, just to think a bit more strategically about the podcast and do some different things. So we've been doing some live episodes. We were lucky to be flown over to Ireland to do a live episode with Sean Ryder from Happy Mondays, and we are going to record that as a standard episode quite soon. So Sean Ryder's going to be coming on soon, which is going to be very special. We did a live episode with three of the 1975 touring bands. So regular listeners will know Don, Polly and Gabby, who've appeared on the podcast in the past. We hired a place called the Courtyard Theatre in Shoreditch, and we did a brilliant night where I interviewed them for 45 minutes. They each played live as well and talked about headlining Glastonbury only a few weeks before. And the live performances, John does his kind of his jazz sax stuff, which was cool. And then Polly did her kind of like surfer kind of acoustics solo material. And then we had 15 minutes of Gabby doing drum and bass on drums, which was fucking amazing. And we had a live audience Q&A and it went beautifully. I mean, wait 10 years really to do a live episode. And you know, someone came up to us afterwards and said it was the best night out they'd had in 15 years. I said, what happened 15 years ago? And they were like, it's my wedding day. So it obviously landed quite well. So we've been busy kind of doing that type of stuff. So Sean Ryder, the live episodes with 1975 as well. We also went, I'm really proud that we went, I hate the word viral because it's such a cringy word, isn't it? But a really huge story, if you follow us on our Instagram, was that we had an episode with Daisy Spencer, who was part of Olivia Rodrigo's band. And she revealed in the episode that Olivia Rodrigo pays for free therapy and counselling for every member of a touring party. What was so cool about it is that story just went about as viral as it could possibly go to. It's now seen by 300 million Instagram accounts. We appeared in the LA Times, ABC News, Huffington Post, Hindu Times, pretty much every major news outlet globally you could find that story in. And what's been really cool is I've seen people since and said, oh, you know, about this story about Olivia Rodrigo offering free therapy and counselling. And people have seen that story. They're like, oh, I didn't have no idea it was to do with your podcast and doing stage left. So that's something that was exciting. We were kind of managing in the background too. We've also landed some sponsorships. So we've done this podcast for 10 years where we've just been like smashing out episodes constantly. And we wanted to take a pause after 10 years and just think about how we're going to kind of take this forward. And so we've landed some sponsorship with a shirt company who is worn by Mick Jagger and Noel Gallagher and a lot of other people as well. So you'll hear that at the beginning of the next episode. And also we've recorded two upcoming episodes in partnership with a university which means there's going to be a live audience there, and there's going to be actually students asking questions as well as myself. So it'll be the typical kind of interview that I do, but also some students asking questions as well. And we've recorded two episodes in that format, one with Woody from Bastille and the other with Russ, Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds, who both have appeared in the past and both have been kind of seen as quite magical episodes for a lot of people, particularly Russ's one. I mean, that's a classic one. Those who've been following the podcast for many years, we recorded that in Rome when Noel Gallagher was supporting U2 at the Rome Olympic Stadium, and that was a hell of a day. So Russ is back on, so we're going to be releasing these episodes in January or February in the new year. Other things just to kind of mention as well, we've got new merchandise. Where's my bag? I've got a bag here. I know some of you will be listening to this. It's recorded on video as well. So we've got, look at this, some new bags with Stage Left Podcast logo on there. We've got hoodies as well. We've got T-shirts. We've got mugs. Go onto our Instagram page. That's where a lot of stuff is happening, and our TikTok as well. So at the Stage Left Podcast, and you'll be able to find some stuff. Listen, we don't make any money really out of podcasting. You know, few people make money out of the music industry as it is, that I'm just people talking about it. But this takes, you know, it's a 14-step process to produce every single episode, and there are people behind the scenes who are helping out as well. So if you can contribute in any way towards that, that'd be fantastic. So if you go onto our Instagram page, you'll be able to find links to our Printify where you can choose what you want. It could be T-shirts, hoodies, you can change the colours. But if you could support us, that'd be very special to us. So please do that. And the last couple of things, you know, to mention as well, we had some very special nights out as a, you know, thank you to Christian Madden, who we appeared on the podcast years ago, and at the time was Liam Gallagher's keyboardist, and we recorded that episode at his place in Clitheroe, and we re-released it actually in last summer. And he said something really profound to me, which was, he said, you know, we never know where the next gig is coming from. And he said there's a proverb he heard from years ago, which is plow diligently and expect no harvest. Just keep chipping away, chipping away, chipping away. Expect no harvest and good things will come. And of course, it was a real kind of March, April that he was the going to be the keyboardist for Oasis for the one of the biggest reunion shows or series of shows there's ever been. And he managed to, without even asking, he kind of said, did you get tickets? I was like, no. He said, let me sort you out. And so we went to the first show back in Cardiff and took my mate Paul. And it was very, very special. I would say there's been a few events in my life where I feel kind of it felt like it was the center of the universe. And I'd say one of them was I went to the final of the Euros in 2021 when England got to the first final in like whatever it was, 60 years, 50 or 60 years. And yeah, this felt kind of similar to that. Actually, the police had shut off the city centre of Cardiff. So it was just kind of just people walking about, enjoying the day. It was a perfect sunny day. And just the hype and the build-up was so special. And to go and get our tickets and we had the passes and all that type of stuff. It was just priceless, really. Just an amazing experience. And thank you to Christian for making that happen. And then we went to the show and there was like a bar and there was a few interesting faces in there and spoke to some really interesting people. And then in for the gig and, best thing about that gig for me is they made a choice to close the stadium roof. So all that build up and all that hype, it's the first time that the Gallagher brothers were going to be walking on stage together. And it just felt it was accentuated and made even more special by the fact it was just closed off. And honestly, I've been to kind of stadium gigs in the past and I've never been to a stadium gig that actually felt intimate. Can you believe it could feel intimate? How does a stadium gig feel intimate? And it did because of that decision. So I think that's a really cool thing that they chose to do. And then also I went to the to one of the Wembley shows. That was a fun night. We took my partner and we also went with Woody from Bastille, who I just mentioned earlier, and we had a very special time down the front. He if you go onto our Instagram, there's some really good reels from that evening and both of those gigs actually. And he put me on his shoulders for Slide Away. So I was kind of like just a few meters from the front on the shoulders. Of a guy who's playing, selling out, the O2 Arena and arenas himself, and it was a very special night for all of us who were there. And yeah, there was other yeah, Ross from the 1975 turned up as well, and some Josh from UB at six, and a few other people as well. And it was just although I didn't drink for this gig actually, everyone else was drunk, and I actually decided to drive and had to get people home who were a little bit worse than where. Which was quite fun, but that was a magical gig. The band played great, fantastic set list. I mean, you really wouldn't change that set list. I don't think there's not too much you'd add or subtract from. And had some really fabulous conversations with Steve Hamilton, who was playing on the shows as well. So he's been on podcasts in the past, and he's the sax player. So he played on the Master Plan, and I think played on Half the World Away, and kind of three or four other songs as well. And it was wonderful to spend time with him. He's invited my partner and my kids to their place in the south of France. So we might do that next year, which is going to be really special. Might record another episode while we're out there, possibly. And also to see Christian as well was pretty magical, taking it in his stride. And, that proverb came true, didn't it? So, yeah, brilliant, brilliant couple of gigs. The last couple of things I just want to touch upon, it's quite sad, really, the news, obviously, of Manny passing from the Stone Roses, just to say that. There'll be a lot of people who listen to this podcast who'd have loved Manny like I did and who love the Stone Roses. And I can't really think of that many. I've been kind of racking my brain since he passed away a couple of weeks ago that to think of many other bands or bass players whose bass plays such a central prominent role in kind of the main hooks and the main melody. Sometimes you'd think, oh, that's John Squire's part on guitar. Actually, it wasn't. It's actually Manny. And he played such a prominent role. And I was very privileged to meet him twice. And my takeaways from that, the first time was backstage at Fee Festival in, I don't know what year it was, mid-2000s, maybe late 2000s. What struck me is me and my friend Matt, we're having a good time, reading that what you will. And we went into the Primal Scream changing room and we were really hungry. My friend Matt just nicked a banana. And then we saw Manny. And we were like, we just stole a banana from the Primal Scream changing room, Manny. And he seemed to be as enthused or as found it as funny or silly or just boys fucking about, basically. And enjoyed that as much as kind of we did. And that's something I've seen a few people say, that actually when you met Manny, which was such a privilege, he just seemed to be as happy to meet his fans as he was the fans to meet him. And it felt authentic. It wasn't like he was kind of putting the face on, and like, oh yeah, okay. He actually genuinely just seemed to be having such a laugh just at the fact that we were just being silly lads basically, who were fans of his, and saying, oh, we love this song, or whatever we were probably saying at the time. And there's a great photo of him and I, and he just seemed to be, I don't know, you just look at that photo and sort of find it on Instagram and our socials. He just seemed to be just really kind of, don't know, what's the phrase I want to use here? He just seemed to be really happy to meet fans in a really authentic way. And he didn't strike me as someone who'd been in the public eye for a long time. He was kind of tired of it. And that was a really beautiful thing. And I met him again. He was doing a DJ set when I was at uni in Bournemouth, and met him then as well. And sadly, the day that he died, I was having a conversation with someone at the prospect of, some of you might know that Manny was kind of doing these tours of kind of an evening with, and Sean Ryder is doing those as well. And as mentioned earlier, I've just interviewed him, and they kind of say, well, you can be on the subs bench to do some of these interviews. And so I kind of walked away from that conversation thinking, oh, well, Manny's doing about 90 dates, something like that, and they probably gonna need someone on the subs bench. And given that I was gonna be on the subs bench with Sean Ryder, I was like, I've like a fairly good chance, like I can end up interviewing Manny on stage. And I remember being really excited by it. And literally about an hour later, I saw a social media post which said that he'd passed away that morning. It's a tough one, really, really sad news. And a great artist, and a great bass player. Which takes me on to the final thing I want to say, which is the passing of Steve Cropper, who was one of the greatest guitarists of all time, voted by Mojo as the second greatest guitarist of all time at one stage behind Jimi Hendrix. And I interviewed him probably 20 episodes into Stage Left. And it was without doubt, by that stage, the most nerve-wracking interview I'd ever done. And we're going to bolt it onto the end of this episode, because I remember first hearing his music and hearing Booker T and the MGs. I was introduced to him by someone called John Stewart, now Dr. John Stewart, who has been on the podcast in the past. He's a guitarist from Sleeper, and some of you will know that band. And I remember being really enamored by the drummer, Al Jackson. In fact, I always kind of said, and I've said this to this day, that I've never seen a drummer look so natural behind a drum kit, and you should check out some of the footage. But of course, Prop Cropper was on stage with him at the same time, and Donald Duck Dunn. And to get this interview was just such a big deal for me. I really felt out of my depth. It'd be interesting listening back to it. I probably sound a bit kind of wet behind the ears and a bit kind of nervous, I'd imagine, because I was. And I just remember doing loads of research for it, and remember feeling kind of a buzz from him that there was someone who was kind of then markedly younger than him. And that was kind of fed back to me afterwards as well, that kind of knew so much about his work. And just kind of the fact that, when he co-wrote Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, this kind of revelation that Otis Redding couldn't play chords, playing shapes on guitar. So what Steve Cropper did is he tuned guitar to E, and Otis kind of co-wrote the song with him, just sliding up and down the fretboard, which is the reason why it has such a unique tone to it, given that there's no minor chords. You'd think about Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, you think it's quite a kind of chilled song, you think there'd be some minor chords in there, and there's not any minor chords because of that reason, that he was just tuned to a major chord that he was sliding up and down the fretboard. I remember thinking that was really special, and I remember telling Mike Rowe about from Oasis and Noel Gallagher's band about that story, and he was like really blown away by that story. So even for musicians, I think it was a big deal. And I remember also how excited someone called Jennifer Batten was, who'd also been on the podcast just beforehand. She was away, sorry, was Michael Jackson's guitarist, so you might remember, the big blonde hair, and playing during the Bad era and a couple other eras as well. And she was like, I remember getting him to sign my guitar. Steve Cropper is the number one person. So there felt a lot of pressure on this interview. And it went okay from my perspective. And his manager, Geddes, afterwards, he sent me a message, which I kept, which said, I've never heard Steve talk so highly of an interviewer, which probably changed my life going forward from that, because that kind of gave me the belief that I could have a go at kind of people asking people questions and holding silence. That's all it is, really, isn't it? So I think what we're going to do is we're going to bolt that episode on to the end of this. And just a reminder that in the new year, we've got some new episodes. So in January, we're going to have Woody from Bastille. February, we're going to have Russ from Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds. We've got Sean Ryder lined up as well, Jamie Oborne as well from Dirty Hit Records, and a number of other people too. So thank you for sticking with us over the last 10 years. Do please buy some of our merch because it helps us and it keeps the episodes flowing. As I say, mugs, hoodies, t-shirts, bags, tote bags, like stickers for your back of your laptop, that type of thing, loads of stuff, badges. Get involved. Thanks, everyone. Here's to the next 10 years.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. Today we are joined by a giant in the world of popular music, a man who's written and played on numerous songs that are woven into the fabric of Western culture, the unique and legendary Stax songwriter, guitarist and producer, Steve Cropper. Today we'll be discussing an incredible career that spanned 5 decades, highlights of which include appearing as a member of the Blues Brothers Band, recently playing the White House at the request of President Barack Obama, and of course writing the classic Sitting on the Dock of the Bay with Otis Redding, which was recorded just a couple of weeks before Otis tragically passed away, aged only 26. Steve's work in the music industry has been recognised by the Songwriters Hall of Fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and Steve even received a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Grammys alongside bandmates Booker T and the MGs. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than the number one numero uno guest that we wanted to get on the show when we came up with the concept. It's the legendary Steve Cropper. Thanks for joining us today, Steve. How's it going?
My pleasure. Everything's going great.
Good, good, good. Thanks for
Not
joining us.
Weather right now, but we're expecting storms this afternoon, so there you go.
Well, we had a. I'm over in London, and we actually had snow yesterday, and it's nearly May.
No, really?
Yeah, and. It was kind of appropriate because
early in the year for that. Okay,
you may know a Prince song is actually called "Sometimes It Snows in April," and so obviously we're recording this just after he passed away. And it snowed in London in April yesterday. Would you believe? I know you put a message up about Prince on your Facebook a couple of days ago. You know, you're obviously a legendary guitarist. He was another guitarist. What did he do for the guitar world for you?
Well, I mean, the guy, he was just so. Talented all the way around. Everybody wants to focus in on certain things, but he was multi-talented. My impression of him was very good because he was so well-rounded and he did so many things. When I found out that he engineered, he produced, he wrote songs, he sang, he played guitar, he would go on stage and entertain people, that's pretty well-rounded, and that really, really impressed me. And I talked to a few people that worked with him. I got to work with the engineer that cut a lot of his stuff. And I talked to some artists that actually worked with Prince. I never did physically get to meet him. I was on a show that he was on one time. And he came out and did sort of that same thing he did on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where he played an incredible solo and then threw his guitar to the audience, you know. So that's pretty impressive. My wife tells the story that we've been married 27 years. And she said, as far as she knows, Prince was the only concert I ever asked to get tickets for.
Right, okay.
That probably is true. Usually they're just given, and anybody that comes to town, you know, I get a call saying, hey, so-and-so's coming, how many tickets do you need? But for Prince, you know, sold out downtown, I asked to get tickets and got them and enjoyed the show. It was fantastic. I didn't go backstage to meet him. I should have and probably could have, but I didn't do it. And I had my wife and family with me, and we left the minute the concert was over. But he was a fantastic guitar player. I did get to hear him in action and see him in action a couple of times, but I never did actually physically meet him, no.
I think that's a great tribute from someone like yourself. And you've obviously done a lot yourself in very different guises in the music industry, Steve. I mean, you not only just a guitarist, obviously you've written some great songs and you've produced lots of great records as well. Which of those three is closest to your heart, producing, songwriting, or being a guitarist?
Boy, that's a tough one. I get asked that question all the time. What do you like to do best? I like doing whatever I'm doing at the time. If I'm engineering and mixing something, or we're starting with a new artist and creating a new song, or if I'm writing, or if I'm playing on stage, I just enjoy the moment as best I can. That's all I can tell you.
Going back to your childhood, Steve, if we can start there. You obviously.
I didn't have one. I was working on a farm feeding animals. So there you go.
That was the childhood.
I wasn't pulling weeds or getting stuff out of the garden for dinner, I was feeding the chickens and helping Dad milk the cows and my grandparents as well. And there was never a dull moment for me until I was way in my teens and almost out of high school.
And what do you think if you hadn't got into music, you would have been destined to do? What do a lot of the kids from where you were growing up do now, or what were they doing?
You know, I have a 15-year-old now, and I have a 21-year-old, and I have older kids. But the thing that I see that I really feel like I can't do a lot about, I can try to be a good dad and all that, but they're going to miss out on so many of the things that we just took for granted and would weigh one against the other and logically come up with a solution. These kids today are so far advanced technically, but they miss out on a lot of the small stuff. They don't really, I'm gonna play dumb here. They don't really know why and how grass grows or how to make it grow taller or greener. Maybe that's not important because most of them live on sidewalks anyway or concrete floors, so they don't have yards. They don't have to have animals. They don't have animals to take care of unless they've got a pet, and they know what that's like. So I think they miss out on a lot. But they're writing songs and they're creating, and that's what counts. And that's, to me, that's what makes the world turn, is putting people in a nice situation where they can get rid of their day-to-day chores and troubles and sort of drift away in the moment on a good song or good entertainment, go out at night. And it's not about drinking. It's about the camaraderie and taking your mind off your daily chores. That I got credited for and successful with just sort of fell in place. But when I took up songwriting, I wanted to be successful at it, and I basically was. That's where I started when I was about 14 years old. And then some buddies of mine in school played guitar, so I wanted to play guitar, and I got one, and I wasn't very good, but I sort of learned how to do stuff with it later and learned a lot from them, and I owe them for that. And most of it was what we coin a phrase over here called on-the-job training. So I get credited for playing guitar, but I never did get to sit in my room and study guitar a lot. In the early days, right out of high school, I was in the studio producing and making records and playing guitar on sessions. And I was sort of flying by the seat of your pants. And I did learn to create a style of guitar that the buying public actually liked, and that's great. So there are a lot of greats. There are guys that really know the guitar, and I was fortunate enough to produce some of the greatest guitar players on the planet, so I was exposed to that stuff. When you get to produce people like Jose Feliciano and Robin Ford and Jeff Beck and all that, I mean, that kind of spoils you for the rest of the industry. imitate them very well or create them. We had a couple of good ones over here, you know, like Jimi Hendrix and so forth. But that English music has always been something I've been fond of, and so have a lot of people. I mean, it shows up in the sales and so forth, and the influence that people like the Beatles and Animals and so forth created. And I hope some of your fans out there know that I have actually gone out and done 3 tours in England with the original English Animals, with John Steele's band.
Yeah, yeah. That was
a lot of fun. And so the neat thing that I brought back over here was that most of the fans were my age, which is slightly younger. When you play over here, even though you're an old guy on stage, or when you go to Japan or go to, we just got back from Australia, that's more of a young crowd, and they accept the older players if they know some of their music, and so it's a little bit different crowd wise. But in England, I get to play for the fans that grew up with my music, and it's really interesting for me. The questions they ask and meeting them and signing autographs backstage is just, you know, you can't describe how great that is.
Obviously, we're recording this. Obviously, I'm English, and we've got a big obsession, like most of the world, with the Beatles and John Lennon. I think you had quite a close relationship with John Lennon. Is that right?
Well, I wouldn't say real close. I knew all of the Beatles, and I would say relationship in the studio. I played on more Ringo Starr records than anybody else. I've met Paul several times. We never did have a close relationship, but we recognized each other and had a mutual respect. And so he's the only Beatle I actually hadn't done anything with. I used to sit out in Beverly Hills and talk for hours with George, and we just talked different things. It wasn't always about guitar. We could have sat down with guitars and written some things, but we didn't do that. We just talked about other stuff.
What was John like?
Oh, John Lennon. Well, I think John was very reserved, very proper. You know, he was a gentleman. They're all gentlemen. I think Ringo, by comparison, has a little bit more fun with his life and whatever, and he's just more of a comical, funny guy. I thought John was a little bit more serious, but man, some of the songs he wrote, some of those lyrics are fantastic. And I mean, he had a great sense of humor. They all did. Every one of them did. But I think, you know, Lennon was very serious. George was very serious. Paul is very serious. And Ringo just likes to have a good time. He just puts everybody at ease. But when it comes time to work, Ringo's right there. He's the workhorse.
So let's go back. Thanks for that insight. Let's go back to your early days writing songs. I believe you wrote a song that ended up being the B-side to a Bill Justice song. I think you're only 15 at this stage.
And well, how lucky can a teenager get is all I can tell.
Right, how did that happen?
Bill Justice had his first big hit number one record was called Raunchy. Then his second one was called College Man, and he wore a college jacket with a letter on it with a big J, and he wore a beanie with a propeller on it being silly, and he had a song called College Man. His third release was called Canadian Sunset or something like that, and I had the B-side. And to explain what that means to the young fans out there today, it's different about what gets released and, you know, on digital and so forth. But in those days, they only had 45 records when I was growing up. I mean, they had 78s too before I really became a teenager. But the flip side, if you wrote a song and it was on the flip side, from the publisher's standpoint, when they start paying for records and pennies and so forth, you would split that income the same as you with the guy that wrote the hit side, which in one respect it's a little unfair, but it should give a major boost to an upstart, I'll guarantee you that. Me, what do I enjoy most? I can probably tell you something you would never think of. The thing that really thrills me more than anything is hearing something I wrote and produced on the radio. When I hear that back, I don't think about the outcome of it or the success of it or whatever. That thrill alone just blows my mind. And I can't really explain that feeling. It's just something. It's better than having a birthday. It's better than Christmas morning. It's better than, you know, than anything you can think of. It, for me, that's what it does. It just charges me up and go, wow. And I get the, I get that a lot these days because there's so many fragmented radio signals from, you know, satellite radio and all these different programs. And I'm just constantly pushing buttons. And every now and then I hit one of my songs. I go, wow, you know, how cool is that? I'm gonna wait.
Tell us about Green Onions and how that came back, because that was a B-side originally, is that right?
Well, it was, and something that we never really did at Stax. Weekends were off. It was a five-day week, Monday through Friday. I used to hold auditions on Saturday. We never played on Sunday. And Jim Stewart came to us and said, came to Booker and Alan Duck and myself, or actually it was Lou Steinberg at the time, Lou Steinberg, and said, would you guys do me a favor this Sunday? Could you come in around 1 o'clock and do a session? There's a friend of mine I want to, you know, cut some stuff on. And his name was Billy Lee Riley. Well, actually, Billy had a late night on Saturday night before, and he showed up late for the session. And Miss Axton up in the record shop said he actually came through the door, but he never came back in the studio. So we just assumed he didn't show, and we were just playing around just to keep our chops warm and whatever, playing some blues. Well, Jim Stewart pushed the record button and recorded that and asked us to come up to the control room to listen to it. And he said, what if we wanted to put something like this out? Would you, do you guys have something you could put on the B-side? There we go with B-sides again. And we just looked dumbfounded. We go, Jim, you're not, we're talking about Jim Stewart, the owner of Stax Records. You're not serious, are you? And he said, well, I might be. I don't know. This is pretty good. And I looked at, we looked at each other just dumbfounded and said, we don't have anything. And I remembered a riff that Booker T played me a couple of weeks prior to that session that he thought might be a good riff for a vocal song, to write a song. And I confronted Booker with it, and I said, you remember that riff you played me a couple of weeks ago? And he said, I don't know, let's go down to the organ and let's see. And he started playing Green Onions, that riff. It's actually backwards. So people think the melody is the left hand and it's not, it's the right hand. But I said, that's it. And I think we made three cuts on it, and one of them happens to be the one, Green Onions. And I took it to a buddy of mine, a disc jockey, who had drive time in the morning. I called Scotty Moore, who people, if they know Scotty Moore, was Elvis's guitar player, but he was also an engineer at Sun Records and ran a lathe where you cut parts for records. And I called Scotty and I said, could you make me a dub on a song we cut yesterday afternoon? And he said, well, yeah. So I bring down, take it down there, had no title or anything. I put it on. He said, that's pretty catchy music. He said, that sounds really good. And I said, well, thanks. So on Tuesday morning, I took it over to my friend who had drive time, Reuben Washington at WLOK, and got it. And I took it down there just for him to hear it. What I didn't know, he put it out on the radio, on the air, and the phone started lighting up. And people wanted to know who it was, who was the band, what was the title of the song, where could they find it? And there was no information. There was no band. So we called an emergency meeting that afternoon of Booker T and wound up Booker T and the MGs and started naming the song. And I think Louis Steinberg said, oh, Onions. Because that's the stinkiest music I ever heard. And I said, well, Onions is a little negative. Why don't we name it Green Onions? And they all agreed. So that's what we did.
My favourite drummer of all time, I remember he's Al Jackson. I remember where I was and what I was doing when I first saw him play the drums. And I remember thinking that he had the perfect technique than any other drummer I'd ever seen. From a technical point of view, what made Al such a great drummer to work with from your point of view?
Well, as far as being a drummer, and we're not talking about his personality because he was one of the greatest guys you'd ever want to meet, two things Al could do that we at that time had never heard another drummer do. One of them was to keep perfect time, number one. And number two, he played a shuffle like nobody else could ever play a shuffle. And we used to go listen to him when he was playing at nights with Willie Mitchell. And we kept for months and months trying to hire Al as our session drummer. He said, I can't do it. I can't leave Willie. And finally, we arrived, or he and Jim Stewart arrived at a compromise if he would come down and play drums for us during the week. And he said, no, I still got to play tonight with Willie. And said, fine, we'll have you out of the studio in time to go eat and get ready to go to your gig and all that, which we did. And but he was supposed to be exclusive to Stax after that deal, but he still went over and after they would get off of the stage at about 2 a.m, go into the studio and start recording around 3 until daylight, and they did a lot of the Al Green hits. So there's a lot of fans out there that probably don't know that that's Al Jackson playing drums on Al Green's hits. He didn't play on all the album cuts because during the day they would use other drummers. And most of those drummers that are on there had been at Stax at one time, or we got them to come over and play on things too. So they're heroes in their own right. But there were so many people, so many drummers and musicians in Memphis that wanted to copy Al Jackson because he was just fantastic. And he was, like I said, one of the greatest timekeepers that I have ever worked with. In the old days, when we didn't have technology we have today, we used to edit tapes and put them together. If you didn't physically change the tempo of a song during the production of it, you could edit take one with take nine, and they'd fit exactly because Al would not change that tempo. And that's what I liked about Al Jackson. And Tom Dowd got impressed with him for the same reason.
And Duck Dunn, obviously one of your oldest friends, amazing bass player. What made him unique from a technical point of view?
Well, you know, I think when I look back on, Duck was so talented, but when I look back on his bass playing career, I think because he didn't have a real, real strong knowledge of music, and neither did I, and I think that rawness is what appealed to the buying public. And, you know, Doug Dunn and I had been together as buddies growing up playing baseball and basketball and football and all the games that kids play since the sixth grade. And he came over, he wanted to learn how to play guitar as well. I think I was in my early junior years, so I'd be early 11th grade or late 10th grade. And a guy named Charlie Freeman was the guy that was taking lessons and learning how to play really good guitar. And he was trying to teach me what he was learning. And so Duck came over to rehearsal and wanted to learn guitar too. He wasn't very good at it. And so we just kind of, you know, we didn't run Duck off or anything. We loved him to death. He was a good buddy. He could hang around as much as he wanted to. But we didn't spend a lot of time trying to teach him how to play guitar. One day he shows up with a bass, an electric bass, and from that day forward, he was our bass player. Well, when we had the hit record Last Night, a year after we graduated, we had that record in 61. We graduated at the end of, in 59, I guess it was. And so we had a year, the end of 59 and almost all of 61, playing nightclubs. That's what we did for a living. We didn't make a lot of money at it, but we played about 7 nights a week. Now, Last Night technically was the first Twist instrumental. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I remember looking back and thinking back, watching my mom when I played her that record way before it hit. She was twisting to it. To see my mom twist or dance to anything was pretty interesting. I never thought about it at the time, but it was the first Twist instrumental.
It's a song that still gets played all the time over here, Steve, Last Night. It gets played, we hear it all the time. It's an absolute classic. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about the incredible story of Johnny Jenkins' session when he came in and his driver who wanted to sing with the band.
Well, at the time, I thought, you know, we'd been waiting outside smoking a cigarette out on the sidewalk because we weren't allowed really to smoke in those days, which was, what was that, about 63. We weren't allowed to smoke in the studio. Jim wouldn't let us smoke, and he wouldn't. But most of the guys in the band smoked, including myself, and so we would go out on the sidewalk and smoke. And we'd been waiting about off and on for a good hour and a half. And there was a phone call the day before saying what time they were leaving Macon, Georgia, about what time they would arrive at the studio. So all of a sudden, this big, long Cadillac pulls up. It parks down just below the record shop there, just below Stax. And this big, tall guy gets out, takes the keys, unlocks the trunk. And I just assumed, since he was driving Johnny gets out, and I knew what, you know, Johnny looked like. And so Otis, this big, tall guy that drove up there, we started taking out amplifiers, guitars, and cables, and microphones. And so I see these microphones, and I go running down there, and I said, "Hey, man, I said, we've got mics already set up in the studio. You don't need mics. You're not setting up like you're doing a gig. We're going to record this session." And he said, "Oh, okay." So he carried in the guitar and the amps and all that. And then the rest of the story is that all day long, he couldn't get to me, but he kept going to Al Jackson, our drummer, and saying, "You got to hear me sing. You got to hear me sing." So Al would come to me. He told Otis at the time, he said, "Well, you know, Steve does all that. He's the A&R director, and he only holds auditions on Saturday." And so he kept bugging Al, I guess, and Al came to me at the end of the session when Jim Sturt said, "Hey, that's a wrap, guys. We'll cut some more stuff tomorrow." And Al came to me up in the control room. He said, "You know that big, tall guy that drove up here?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I told you earlier he'd been bugging me to hear him sing. Would you just," he said, "the guy has been on my back this whole day. Would you just come down and listen to him for a couple of minutes and get him off my back?" So I brought Otis down to the pen, and I had them bring him down there, and I said, "Okay, play something and sing something for me." And he said, "Oh, I don't play piano. I just play a little guitar," he called it. And he said, "But I don't play piano." And he said, can you just give me some of those church chords?" And the church chords that I knew were 6/8 triplets, and I just started playing. Marvell Thomas had been teaching me a little bit on the piano, and I started just playing these triplets. And he started singing "These Arms of Mine," and I just said, I mean, it hadn't been a minute, and I just said, "Stop it right there!" And I went and got Jim Sturt, and I grabbed Jim, and I said, "You got to come down here and hear this guy sing." He said, "He's going to blow you away." So he heard him, and he said, "Man, we got to get this on tape." So Duck reminded me that I come running out of the studio, out on the sidewalk. He said, "I was putting my bass in the trunk of the car, and you said, get your bass back out. We got to put something down real quick." And on "These Arms of Mine," that's Johnny Jenkins playing guitar. I played piano, Duck played bass, I played drums, and we cut "These Arms of Mine," which was Otis's first hit record.
These arms are mine.
The only thing that I can tell you that was different about sitting on the dock of the bay, he started it in Sausalito, at Bill Graham's boathouse in Sausalito. And rather than, he says ships in the song lyrics in the first verse, he was actually talking about the ferries coming over from Oakland to Sausalito. And that's what he meant by watch them roll in, watch them roll away again, because they put up a wake whenever they do that. I always thought he was talking about ships under the Golden Gate Bridge. I helped him finish the song, the second verse and the bridge, and, you know, left my home in Georgia and all that and everything. And we wrote it together. The thing that's different about sitting on the dock of the bay, when he brought it to me, he said, "Crop, I've got a hit." Whenever we finished recording it, we both said, "That's a hit. That's going to be your biggest record." And lo and behold, who knows if he hadn't passed away, whether it had been a hit or not, we'll never know that. But we do know that's the biggest record that Otis ever had.
And you wrote some of the lines for the second verse, is that right?
Yeah, I wrote most of the second verse. If you look on Otis's Best Of or any of his albums and you see my name attached to some of the songs, the lyrics will be about Otis Redding. I'm a love man. They call me Mr. Pitiful, all those things. You know, I wrote about Otis. And he just took it for granted and just, okay, that sounds good, and he's singing. He wasn't singing it from an egotistical standpoint. He didn't think about it that way. He just thought I was writing about somebody else. And he wrote some songs, some lyrics, sometimes that I even questioned. It took me years to figure out what he was talking about. There's one of the songs where he says, "I lost someone just like you." And I thought he was talking about a girl. No, he was talking about another guy who had lost someone. "I lost someone just like you did." But he didn't use the word "did." He left that out. So in the English language, if he said, "I lost someone just like you did," it would have been explainable. But he didn't. He said, "I lost someone just like you." And he's singing about a girl. So we think I thought he was singing about it. I said, "That doesn't make sense." Well, it did later. So,
Is it right that he never actually heard the version that was released because you were still working on it? Is that right? What was it? How did it differ, the version that he last heard to the version that we know so well?
You mean Dock of the Bay?
Yeah, because you played it on acoustic guitar. Is that right? You recorded it on acoustic guitar.
Otis Redding never heard the electric guitar licks. He also never heard the waves or the seagulls. Wow. I did that when I mixed it. The electric guitar parts I did after he was headed to the airport to go to his gig, and I forgot. I didn't have one that Friday night, but Booker T and the MGs had, a show at Illinois State University that Saturday night, and I forgot, and Booker either called or when I got home, they said, "You know, you got to be at the airport and such, you got a gig tomorrow night." So, but there was Otis never heard the final mix, and he didn't hear the guitar licks, and he didn't hear the ocean waves and seagulls. The acoustic guitar, the horns and all that, we did live. So he had heard all of that.
And who wrote the instrumentation? Who did the instrumentation? Was that between you? Did he write the chords, or did you write the chords, or how did that work?
No, Otis did. And for the music buffs out there, unless it was a cover song, anything that Otis wrote, you'll never hear any minors in there, because he didn't know how to play minors. So I had to learn to do that too. So when musically and technically something's supposed to go to the 6 minor or the 2 minor, it goes to a major. And he just sang it that way, and it seemed to work. I don't know. Other people couldn't get away with that.
That was one of my questions. It's such an unusual song in the fact that it's quite a melancholic song, and there's no minor chords in it at all. It's all majors and sevens. Very unusual.
Make it simple for you.
Yeah.
Otis Redding wrote on a guitar all the time, and he always had 14 to 15 ideas he was working on. But he played the guitar. It was tuned to a chord, to an E chord. And he played with one finger up and down, either his thumb wrapped over or his first finger, and that's how he made all of his changes, and so that's how he came up with all that stuff. And so I started on sessions. I had a couple of Telecasters, and I tuned one to a chord and the other one straight, and I went on tour with him in 67 and did the same thing. And unfortunately, I had a guitar stolen, the one that was tuned to a chord at the 3 Falk Three Falk Hotel, but 3 Falk Auditorium. We were doing a show in Copenhagen, Denmark, and we took a break because it was a long show with a lot of people on it. And when I came back, I go, and Otis is coming in, going to be, you know, he closed the show. He was the last artist. And I happened to look back and see that one of my guitars was missing. I got one strapped on, the other one. I said, "Where's my other guitar? I didn't use it. I'd only use it on Otis. So who took it?" Well, we never did find out. So I had to learn very quickly how to play Otis Redding songs not tuned to a chord.
that's awesome.
So that includes, and today I've always used standard tuning. So I've learned how to play all of those songs that I played tuned to a chord, just regular standard tuning.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, then I watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm just sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time.
was always told that the old guys that tuned to a chord and played with a slide, they referred to it as Vassapoo. I don't know how you spell it, but that's what they call. And somebody informed me a few years ago, well, Vassapoo was a different tuning. It wasn't an E chord. And I'm going, oh, really? I never knew that. I was always told it was called Vassapoo. If they used a chord to slide where they couldn't finger different, you know, inversions of chords, that it was called Vassapoo. But I guess I was wrong technically. And I don't know if we can look it up in the dictionary or we'd have to dig up somebody to find out what the real meaning is, I guess.
I'll do some research and I'll send it to you. I'll try and find out.
You might ask some old blues guys over there in England if they know what Vassapoo is and can explain it.
I'll try and find out for you.
There you go.
Two other guys that you worked with, Sam and Dave, their energy live was incredible at those live gigs. What were they like for you? They must have been wild.
Well, energy-wise, you can't beat Sam and Dave. And so it was sort of like whenever they were performing live, they were trying to outdo each other dance-wise, I guess. But Sam Moore, who's still with us, you know, was the singer. And Dave Prater was not necessarily a great singer, but he could carry a tune, but he didn't have a big range. So that made Sam sing down a lot, sing lower than his normal range would have been. The difference in that is that he could dance like nobody's business. So when they entertained the audience, they were just dancing up a storm and singing. And I think what you started with, tell us about the energy of Sam and Dave. And so I think it was as much about their entertainment and dancing as it was the music, even though Isaac Hayes and David Porter wrote some great, fantastic songs like Hold On, I'm Coming and Soul Man and so forth, which have become classics, as we all know. But there nothing could ever take the place of Sam and Dave's entertainment. It just can't do it. And I don't know anybody that can sing any better than Sam, and he's still alive today and still out there doing it, and that's fantastic. I mean, there's a lot of great singers, but nobody can touch Sam Moore.
You played the lead guitar on Soul Man. Is that right? That's you on the intro. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
That's a classic line. I wonder if you could tell us.
You know, the connection to that, and they said, well, how come you didn't get part writers? I said, well, that's, you know, I just helped Isaac Hayes with an intro. That's all I did. And the thing about it is that we had a production pool, so we were all involved in producing the song, and that's the way we did it. And maybe that's why Stax was so successful, because it was more of a family situation. And we all worked together as a team. So that's probably why we were so successful, because in sports, one man can't win a game. He might put in the final basket that wins the game, but you got to get there first. And it takes a team to do that, to get that person in that position. So we worked as a musical team on all of those sessions, on Otis, on Eddie Floyd, on Sam and Dave, on Rufus Thomas.
I wonder if you could talk to us about working on the Blues Brothers film, what that must have been like, particularly the scene in Ray's Music Exchange when you're doing Shake Your Tail Feather. I only watched it on Saturday. It was such great fun.
The movie business is so far removed from the record business. I don't even know how to explain the connection. You know, we did appear to be playing live and all that, and I think we did on some of the things in the second movie, but the first one, all that stuff is pre-recorded in the studio. And you pre-record it in the studio the same way you would if you were doing an album or a record. And then they play that back as you're acting and performing. And the good news about the Blues Brothers movie, the same guys that played on it were in the movie, so they knew all the moves, and it looks like we're actually playing live.
That looked like a lot of fun with Ray Charles as well. That was a great scene. Is that something you look back on fondly, Blues Brothers? Because it was a bit of a cult film at the time. It's a great film. Is it something you look back on fondly?
Well, the Blues Brothers band itself has never stopped. Well, we stopped for a while after Belushi died, and then we got it back together. We just returned from Japan. We did 10 shows in Japan and flew down to Australia and did the big pop festival down there for about 11,000 people, and had a great time doing that. And we've got one show to do in June, and I don't have the date with me right now, and then we pick back up at the end of August in the fall, and I think we start up in the Netherlands or something like that.
Fantastic.
And no, I don't have those dates in my mind, but it'll be on the website sometime. Sounds as powerful as it did, maybe even more powerful than it did back when we were making the movie. It's pretty good. We have a lot of fun doing it, and that's why we do it. We got great musicians, and we're getting ready to go up to New York and record a new album. Don't have a label yet, but that's the material. We'll get one and do a show or two. We may wind up in Woodstock doing a show, but we haven't announced it yet because we don't really have the dates and of what we're going to be doing.
That's great to hear. Great to hear. Great band. I wondered, we'll begin to wrap up, Steve. 32 years ago, you said, "I've always predicted Memphis will always survive itself in the music industry." But obviously since then, the music industry has changed so drastically. What fears do you have for the music industry and how might they be addressed?
Well, you know, I don't know where to put. Memphis has never stopped, so I do know that. And they still make great records. They've been doing it for a long time, and they will continue to do so. I've been asked many, many times, could you ever or would you ever put together another situation like Stax? And I don't know. I'm not being negative about it. That was something that happened. It was a phenomenon, and I'm not sure it could be repeated. You could go do something similar maybe, but I don't think you could get put a band of musicians together to show up every Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock and get their instruments ready and record three songs by 3 or 4 in the afternoon, finished and ready to go. I just don't think that could be done today. And number one, technology. Number two, you can't get four musicians' attention that long, I don't think. So.
Okay. And you're on the board of the Stax Museum. Is that a music school as well? Is that correct?
Well, it is. Yeah, the Academy. And it's done so well. The amount of students that we've gained through the years. And one of my favorite things to do every year, I go down and do a little talk or do a seminar or whatever. And these kids just hinge on every word you say. And I learned that from the first time I did it. And I love doing it. Sometimes I'll do that and have them play along or play along with the band there, the Stax Academy band. Or I'll, you know, play with another band and do a concert of sorts in the studio itself. Now there's two different places, they're side by side. So the Academy is beside Stax where the museum is, and the Academy is there and the buildings in behind. So they have plenty of room, recording studio and all that kind of stuff. And these young kids are so good and so talented, and they really put their minds to it. They really want to make it, and they want to do good. So that's the positive end of that Academy, and they're taught well.
What advice do you give to them going into the music industry, both perhaps from a guitarist point of view and then from a music business?
Well, if you've got a dream and want to do it, never give up on it. No matter how discouraging life may become or the business may become and all that, or somebody else telling you. You know, I grew up in an area I didn't have in an era – I didn't have parents that looked at me negative and said, "Oh, son, you want to be a musician, you'll never make it." But other buddies of mine, they had parents that said, "Get a real job, you know." Well, I'm still out here with this real job. And so for all of those parents that looked at their kids and said, "You'll never make it," well, I'm proof that you can make it if you don't give up on what you're doing and you do your job every day like you're supposed to. So I would say the advice, just you'll take it all in, learn what you can, and never give up on your dream.
And what about from the music business aspect? If you're a young musician, let's say there's someone who's, say, 20 years old going into the music industry, there's a lot of sharks out there, supposedly. What steps can they take so that they know about music business and things to do and not to do?
as far as you mentioned sharks and all that, you have to have a certain amount of instinct, and you have to kind of know what you're dealing with. You're not going to be perfect all the time. And if somebody today wanted to do one of two things, either be a songwriter or a musician and start from scratch, I really wouldn't know where to tell them to start. Other than, you know, just start listening to the radio and listen to other things at home, get inspired with it, and then try to find somebody knowledgeable that can teach you other things and help you jumpstart a career or or leapfrog. And it's out there. If you want to search for it and find it, you can find it.
And what are you still learning about music? You're so experienced. So what else are you learning about music as you go along?
Well, I learned that through music, I can put food on the table. Is there anything else to learn? I don't know. I've had pretty much five careers. Do I want a sixth one? I don't think so. I think about at the age where I love sharing my experience, I love doing seminars and talks, and I enjoy doing interviews like we're doing right now.
Fantastic.
To learn something else, I don't know what I would learn. I learn every day that, you know, I love listening to new music. I don't have the desire to go out and either copy it or do something like it. So, I don't know.
It's important to be original. And what burning ambitions do you have left?
Stay alive.
You've achieved everything there is to achieve in the music industry, but I just wondered if there was anything still that you wanted to do.
Well, yes and no, but I enjoy entertaining. I really enjoy playing with the Blues Brothers band. I love doing it when I'm doing it with myself with another band. And to see a crowd of people, whether it's, 2,500 or 25,000, to see them excited about what we're doing excites me. So that keeps me going and keeps me wanting to do it again. So that's a good reason to stay alive.
Great, great answer. Just finally, I wonder if you could just tell us about the incredible day, I think it was about 3 years ago now, that you played at the White House for Barack Obama. What do you remember of that experience and that day? That must have been quite surreal.
Well, I know what I walked away saying. If one artist from Stax gets one job off of us to play in the White House, then it was all worth it. And the feeling of being asked, I don't take it for granted. It's a big honor. I've played the White House about four times. So it wasn't something that was brand new that I'd never done before.
Right.
But what it was a tribute to rhythm and blues and the artists of Stax, and that really intrigued me, and I tried to do my best, even though I played with other artists. I played with the Alabama Shakes, and I played with Justin Timberlake. But Booker was there to play the whole show, and behind Mavis and Eddie Ford and so forth, and I said, man, this is a great day. To be honored at the White House is about as good as it gets. It's like somebody in England getting honored by the Queen.
And what was Barack Obama like towards your music? Was he familiar with a lot of it? I guess he was. I saw him
sit in the front row and wiggle and shake to the whole show. He and Michelle both. So they were enjoying themselves.
Ladies and gentlemen, Steve Cropper. They had to make us follow Mavis, didn't they? You ready?
Sitting in the morning sun. I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, and I watch them roll away.
Fantastic, great stuff. All right, we'll begin to wrap up there, Steve. You know, when we came up with the concept to do a show interviewing people stage left to tell their stories, you were the numero uno. You were the number one guest that we wanted to get on. So it's an absolute pleasure to, you know, that you've agreed to be on the show to share your experience to a future generation of musicians. And we look forward to the next chapter in your career.
Appreciate it. Great questions, and I enjoyed it. And good luck with it.
Thank you very much, Steve. Cheers.
You bet. Take care.
Bye-bye.